This is an evening discussion on another of the so-called festival scrolls in the Old Testament. The three of the five scrolls that we're going to be looking at this week are all scrolls about which there was some debate whether or not they should be in the canon. And the scroll we'll be looking at tonight is the Song of Solomon. And if you've ever had a chance to look at it, you too may have some question about whether it should be in the canon. Today we will be looking at it rather closely, so if any of you want to get Bibles for yourself so you have it in hand and can follow it, you're welcome to do that. Maybe we should take a moment to get them from the back of the room. I think there's a whole row of Bibles back there. As you're doing that, I'd like to say just a word or two about the canon. Perhaps many of you, unless you've had theological training, viewed the Bible, if you were asked about it, somewhat like I think I did, and I would describe it as a beautifully packaged book, probably in black, with ribbons floating directly down from heaven. And, well, here it arrived. And to sit back after we have that kind of an understanding of the Bible and to think about it as a collection, a kind of a library of books written over thousands of years by many, many different authors and then perhaps edited and collected and grouped and rearranged, and that process itself takes quite a period of time, that may come as a shock, and yet as we reflect about it as a marvelous testimony to the way in which, if we believe that God indeed does guide everything, he also guided the collection of these books. Now, in this process, what's interesting, once you've had a look at many of the books which we consider rather central to the Old Testament story, Abraham, God's covenant with him, choosing a people, the people ending up in bondage, the tremendous deliverance out of Egypt, the long march into a promised land, the magnificent kingdom of David, then the gradual decline, the destruction of Samaria, I think in 722, the destruction of Jerusalem in 586, exile, the Jewish people down to just about 2/12 of what they were once, and then in exile for some time and finally returning home. That basic story is the song that we sing and the story that we tell about, and it includes the people that we preach about. But there's another part to the canon besides this story and the prophets who are an intimate part of it, and that's known as wisdom literature. And it is relatively unrelated to this whole historical story. The wisdom literature includes works like Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Job, some of the Psalms, and as we'll see tonight, we're going to also put the Book of Solomon into this connection, for one thing, simply because Solomon is so intimately associated with it, that is to say, the Song of Solomon is named after him. So this context is the place in which we find these so-called festival scrolls, inside the writings, and then some of them are among the wisdom literature. In any case, these books, the so-called wisdom literature books, were probably collected last of all. Some of them may have had great antiquity, but about some of them there was some debate. And this debate comes out indirectly through the Talmudic writings and also some records of the Council of Jamnia, which was held around 90 AD, which you've heard of in other contexts as well. Now, my own personal interest in these so-called marginal books that we're looking at is that they help us establish, sort of like the periphery of a target, where the center is. And yet they have some kind of a connection to that center too. And that's what's so interesting to reflect about. Yesterday, we took a look at the book of Esther. And as one writer said, these peripheral books seem to express some of the intensest emotions that mankind shares. Courage. That would wrap up the story of Esther in one word. Perhaps Lamentations would express human grief. The book of Ruth would express fidelity in not just marriage, but in relationships. Okay, and the Song of Solomon also catches one of those emotions, namely physical love. If it doesn't have bad connotations for you, erotic love, the love between a man and woman, or let us say the mystery and the joy of love between a man and a woman, and most people who look at this book want to insist within the context of marriage. So that's what we're going to look at, this particular book, with this particular theme. Now, there have been a wide range of interpretations of this book. And I think if I would group them into two categories for the moment, the one interpretation is that it really is about the love between a man and a woman. But that would raise some great questions. How could something as human as that be in a sacred book like the Bible? And consequently, already at the earliest time, a great tradition of allegorical interpretation grew up, and that's the second kind of interpretation. That interpretation says the Song of Solomon seems to be talking about the love of a man and woman, but really it's talking about something else. What it's talking about, so the rabbis insisted, was Yahweh's love for Israel, or Yahweh's love for the individual believer. As you can imagine, the early Christian church picked up that same theme, and then it became Christ's love for the church. And there are some interesting New Testament references to the church's relation to Christ in the image of marriage that would substantiate that. Well, this tradition of allegory has gone on through the ages. And in contrast, perhaps, to the book that we read looked at yesterday, Esther, which is perhaps fairly little preached about, in the history of the church, the Song of Solomon has been preached about to no end. For example, Bernard of Clairvaux, I read in one commentary, had 86 sermons on the Song of Solomon. And he only got to the end of chapter 2. The problem with the allegorical interpretations are several. One is that, as one person has so nicely put it, allegory is like a wax nose. You can do almost anything with it. That is to say, there are no limits to the interpretation. I Xeroxed one or two examples of it, and I'll just cite one of them in Song of Solomon chapter 3 verse 7. If you want to look at it, there's a reference to Solomon's litter and the warriors surrounding his bed. Now, there's no indication ever that Solomon occupied a litter, a bed of that kind, the kind that you carry with several men, two in front and two in back, and so on. As a matter of fact, when Solomon went to be crowned, he rode a donkey, a mule. So we don't know about this kind of tradition, and yet some people have suggested that perhaps he did, and maybe it was a reference to that. But others have suggested that perhaps there's a reference to Yahweh's invisible presence in the litter, and that it isn't a reference to Solomon at all, but to Yahweh. The Targums, that's the ancient Hebrew Aramaic interpretations of the Old Testament, made of Solomon's bed the temple. And of the 60 heroes, the letters in the priestly blessing. You know the Aaronic blessing in Numbers 6. If you count out the Hebrew letters, there happen to be 60. I'll just read you one sentence here to see what this sounds like from the Targum. When Solomon, king of Israel, built the temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem, Yahweh spoke his word. How lovely is this temple, built for me by the hand of Solomon, my son, the son of David. And how comely are the priests at the time they spread their hands, standing on their dais and blessing the people of the house of Israel with the 60 letters which were transmitted to Moses, their master, and with that blessing surrounding them like a high and strong wall, and with which all the valiants of Israel are strengthened and prosper. That's the commentary on this verse. Okay. In other words, it takes us away from the immediate story and takes us back into that other Old Testament story that we know so well, Solomon building his temple and so on. Or the priests, now that's a big jump, blessing the people with the Aaronic benediction. Christian interpreters understood Solomon's bed to represent the church because therein the saints delight in embrace of the true Prince of Peace. The 60 valiant men were seen as the doctors who defended the church with their preaching or seek heavenly bliss through contemplation and so on. Later Roman Catholic teachings which really emphasized Mariolatry in connection with the Song of Solomon said that the bed of Solomon also referred to the hallowed womb of the Virgin Mother, fenced about by the patriarchs, kings, and prophets, or by the special guard of angels round the manger of his birth. Other interpretations held the bed to represent Holy Writ, prayer, or the tomb around which the Jews posted a guard, or the final repose of the faithful in the bliss of heaven. Do you see what I mean by a wax nose? You know, where do you stop with this kind of interpretation? Another problem with the allegorical interpretation is that it takes our focus away from the immediate question of the love between the man and the woman. And there may be some other problems in addition to that. In any case, this gives you an idea of, let's say, the two basic modes of understanding the Song of Solomon. There have been several others that are interesting, which I'll just mention briefly. Some people have done a great deal of study of the ancient myths of the Babylonians, of the Baal worship, and there they have found interesting mythologies of gods and goddesses who consort with one another, who miss one another. The god dies, the goddess searches after him in the underworld, and the suggestion has been made that this entire book has to be read in the light of that kind of mythology, and that had somehow crept into Israel's own canon. The difficulty with that is there's hardly any clue directly. It's all reading it into. And furthermore, the very fact that it's in the canon would exclude that kind of interpretation. But commentators have spent tremendous amount of time advancing this theory. In fact, the Anchor Bible, those of you who are interested in the big commentaries, has a commentary that big, over 700 pages on this little 8-chapter book. Just phenomenal, absolutely staggering. Another very popular interpretation that came up about two centuries ago was the dramatic reading. And that was the ancient love triangle. King Solomon, the wealthy king, goes to the north and finds a lovely innocent maiden, and he seeks to bring her back to Jerusalem. Aha, but there's a young shepherd lover with whom she is in love. And the song she sings to him. And Solomon sings to her, and sometimes the shepherd lover sings. And so there's this eternal triangle, which is finally resolved in the end, that Solomon recognizes that this young man is truly worthy of her love, and then he bows out of the picture. Now, it's very interesting because it helps us see that there are a number of voices in the book, as we'll see in a minute. However, once again, there really isn't much support in the book for this love triangle. One other thing that's quite interesting and may have some bearing on the whole book is the following. A German, Jewish attaché in the last century by the name of Wettstein had visited some Syrian weddings as he was doing his government work in Syria and Palestine, and he observed a certain pattern in these weddings where they loved to sing cycles of songs, and there was dancing, there were processions, there was a sword dance, and it was his inspiration that perhaps that kind of tradition lies behind these songs, that they're a kind of collection of songs which may have grown out of wedding festivals or maybe engagement festivals, and that we have them collected here, a secular love festival that's put into a religious context. Perhaps there's an element of truth in all of these. What I'd like to suggest as the thesis that has been most helpful for me personally is that an important clue is given to us in the very first line of the book, namely, it's the superscription, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Traditionally, that term has been taken as a word of authorship. But one commentator, whom Childs, Reverend S. Childs quotes, has said something that's very helpful to me, namely that that is a very modern understanding of authorship, namely this book is the possession of Solomon. Ancient understanding of authorship was quite different. It was traditional, it was communal, it was developing. There was no sense of personal possession, rather it was a community's treasured document. Now, what happens when this gets put into a wider context? Well, I think that puts the Song of Solomon into the realm of wisdom literature, namely Israel's reflection about all of daily life under finally God, and living it wisely under him. That might mean that Song of Solomon, then, is not simply the Song of Solomon as an individual with perhaps his Egyptian bride, but is a reflection of wisdom using Solomon perhaps as an inspirational figure to reflect about the mystery and the joy of the love between a man and a woman within the context of marriage. Now, that would help account for why there's no reference to all of the things that you normally expect in a biblical book. Reference to covenant, not a word about it. Reference to God. Once again, God is not mentioned, except perhaps in one verse indirectly, but it's tricky. There's no reference to promise. In other words, the whole history of Israel is totally absent. And yet that's also the case in wisdom literature. So the opening line helps us, I think, helps me, and may help us put the book into that kind of context. I'd like to suggest that we read it in these terms, and then I'd like to draw on one suggestion that came out of one of Joan Novak's presentations. And if Joan is here, she can correct me on this if I'm not getting it all right. In James Nelson's book, Embodiment, after discussing some of the aberrations of love, alienation, hostility, and so on, he talks about love in its wholeness in terms of reunion, communion, and what was the third, Joan?
Well, self-acceptance, wholeness.
Self-acceptance, wholeness. And then some of the features were of this healing were self-acceptance, sensuousness, which would include playfulness and not the fear of the body, the sharing, caring, and mutuality. Now, what interested me is I've read a number of commentaries on this book, and the commentaries that finally shake themselves free of the allegorical interpretation use words like, this is a poem of erotic love, physical love, sexual love. You hear those words again and again. But very little do I hear an effort to state that the physical and the spiritual are marvelously wedded in this song, so that it brings to voice this chemistry of mutual self-acceptance, of sensuousness, of mutuality. And my thesis is that that's what's happening in this Song of Solomon. Namely, that if you know you're truly loved, you can really be yourself and express your desires, your hopes, your anticipations, your expectations without shame, with complete delight. And on the other hand, if you know you are being desired, you in turn will want to fully give yourself. And it's in this kind of playful, candid, luxuriating back and forth that the two persons speak to one another. And then I think there's a, as many people point out, there's a third group, a kind of, as in Greek comedy and tragedy, a chorus, which comments to both of them. One last thing about, a little bit about the poetic form, and then we'll be ready to look at the psalm. It is a lyric poem, or a collection of lyric poems. That means we shouldn't be looking for a continuous story. Rather, there's an occasion for the expression of emotion, or the felt thought, as it's embodied in some form or another. And then the development of that feeling through certain rhythms, intensity, then maybe cooling off, some detachment, and yet some very close metaphorical statements, so you can't even sort out the meaning from the words. And then finally, some kind of a tailing off of the emotion, and yet in such a way so that you hope this song is going to go on forever. And maybe that makes it one of the Lord's songs that God's people want to sing. Many of you, I think, are familiar with Hebrew poetry. The invitation is always, think Hebrew. Be prepared for some rather shocking comparisons when the girl's breasts are compared to towers. We, today, would snicker, as I do the first time I read that. But if we're talking about the purity of the girl, then the towers will say that she has been unassailable, because any magnificent tower is an untouched fortress. So you have to think in those kind of terms, and you'll get a feel of that as we go along. So there's some remarkable metaphoric language, and we have to be prepared for different kinds of comparisons than we normally are. Another thing to look for, and that is more common, is so-called parallelism. In other words, two lines are put next to each other in pretty much the same form. Sometimes they're contrast, sometimes they're simply saying the same thing in somewhat different language. I think that's as much as I need to say by way of introduction. I'm going to follow one organization which groups the lyrics into about five groupings. And we'll read along. You'll notice some repetitions here and there. I'll comment a little bit as we go along, but I'll also invite your response. And if I can read my notes here, I will try to give you some interesting contrasting or conflicting interpretations, even on the more realistic approach to the book. One last thing I wanted to say, if I may. I understand that the Psalms in ancient Israel were always sung and were meant to be sung publicly. If that's true, I wonder if that might also be true of Song of Solomon, that it too is meant to be sung and to be sung publicly. Perhaps, you know, the occasion was initially a wedding festival. We don't know anymore. It's certainly been taken out of that and put into a liturgical context. The Jews, since the Middle Ages, read Song of Solomon at the time of the Passover, and that's hardly a wedding festival. No. But in any case, it is sung, and so sung, I think, and you'll see it was originally probably sung, and so you will see repetitions of refrain, and that may suggest perhaps even voices singing against one another. Some of you know Bach cantatas, and you know that there are times when the soloist is a man and a woman, and they intertwine their voices. And it's very difficult to follow the text because the voices repeat and overlap and restate themselves. And perhaps there's some of that here too, because you'll see interesting and hard to explain repetitions. Okay, we'll start right out with the first section, which this grouping goes from verse 2 to verse 8, which basically simply establishes the theme of love between a man and a woman. You'll see immediately that it has to do with very physical love. Oh, that you would kiss me with the kisses of your mouth, for your love is better than wine, your anointing oils are fragrant, your name is oil poured out. Therefore the maidens love you. Draw me after you. Let us make haste. The king has brought me into his chambers. We will exult and rejoice in you. We will extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. Very likely it's the bride who sings in the first few verses up to the middle of verse 4, but it's probably the companions who join them there. The break between bride, companions, and groom, which I'll follow, goes way back to the ancient Greek translation of the Old Testament. They put headings in, and if any of you have the NEB, the New English Bible, I believe that the NEB uses those headings. So you hear a difference in voice when somebody says, "We exult and rejoice with you." Most girls, I think, you can check me on this, a little thesis, if they're in love with somebody and not awfully sure about their love and yet are very desirous that that's going to be their man, will probably not tell the whole world about how great he is and how she wants to have the kisses of his mouth. She'll be very secretive of this. How interesting that this girl is so sure, so confident, that she even sings to the maidens. And they respond back and they say, "We rejoice with you." So you see how quickly the whole mood of the poem is established. Luther, who wanted to reject the allegorical interpretation but was nervous about the literal interpretation, took a middle road and says what this poem is about is Solomon governing his people. And the kisses of the mouth are, of course, God's word, addressing his word to his people. And his people who truly want to obey him and as a nation want to obey the king will surely seek the kisses of the mouth that is the word of God. Now, Luther did not want to go for the medieval allegorical of God and the soul, or Israel and God, or Christ and the church. Luther is very interesting, though, and as he goes along, here and there, he toys with the physical and sort of implies that the rabbis were wrong to say no one should look at this before they're over 30 years old, because they'd be inflamed with lust. Luther said, if a person is pure in heart, what he sees, he will see purely. And he makes some other interesting comments along the way to make us realize he is quite aware of what the basic tenor is, and yet he insists on carrying his own little allegory all the way through. That was just by side. Now the bride goes on and says, "I am very dark but comely. O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar and the curtains of Solomon." Usually the tents in this region, and many of the tents, as well as the curtains of Solomon, were made of goat's hair, often a very dark brown goat's hair. And so you're getting a literal depiction here of the color of the girl. She was obviously very tan. Do not gaze at me because I am swarthy, because the sun has scorched me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept. Tell me, you whom my soul loves, where you pasture your flock, where you make it lie down at noon, for why should I be like one who wanders beside the flocks of your companions? Just one or two comments here. At first, she seems to be talking about a vineyard, and it's very likely that she, in fact, was sent out to be a keeper in a vineyard and hence got so tan and swarthy.
The vineyard becomes her very self, and she invites Solomon into her vineyard, and she may be speaking of him as her vineyard. So when she says, "But my own vineyard I have not kept," literally it might be that the family has this vineyard, and this little young girl has her own little vineyard, you know, like kids sometimes have their own vegetable garden. And so she didn't keep her vineyard because she had to go out and tend her family vineyard. Or is it possible that she's suggesting she has made herself vulnerable, in taking care of the vineyard of the family? Because in verse 7, she already is speaking about the one whom her soul loves and wants to know where he pastures his flock. I may say parenthetically that the text is very difficult, and commentators suggest different translations, and it's often very bewildering. I will give you one example of that here. In the middle of verse 7, she says, "For why should I be like one who wanders beside the flocks of your companions?" Some people have suggested that what it really means is, "Why should I be like a veiled harlot beside the flocks of your companions?" And later on, there'll be an image of that. One other translation has suggested that it means that I may not be left picking life beside the flocks of your companions. So the point then would be, why is she put out into this situation when she would want to be with the one she loves? The Hebrew letters, parenthetically, are or used to be simply consonantal, like G, R, S. And the vowel sounds would be very different depending on the meaning of the word. So consequently, various suggestions grow out of the different vowel pointing for those consonant sounds. "If you do not know, O fairest among women, this is now the probably the groom or perhaps the companion speaking, follow the tracks of the flock and pasture your kids beside the shepherd's tent. Now for sure," the groom is speaking, "I compare you, my love, to a mare of Pharaoh's chariot." Again, if we take that literally, it's not very complimentary. But if you think that usually Pharaoh's chariots are only drawn by horses, male horses, by stallions, then it is a most remarkable thing to say that there is one mare, and one mare only among Pharaoh's chariots. So that means she is unique among a place of worth. "Your cheeks are comely with ornaments, your neck with strings of jewels. We will make you ornaments of gold studded with silver." The bride, in response, dialogues that, "Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves. You are beautiful, my beloved, truly lovely." And the groom responds, "Our couch is green. The beams of our house are cedar. Our rafters are pine." That already leads up to one of the next parts of the poem, which is going to be much more intense and emotional. Here they're still talking to one another, and he's saying, "I have a lovely arbor with a lovely room, and look at the beautiful rafters on the ceiling and the beams of the house." The first two verses of the next chapter still probably go with the initial part of the poem, namely this dialogue of the lovers. She, of course, speaks of herself as the rose of Sharon. Actually, that probably is a reference to the crocus, or some people have said the asphodel. So there are many different flowers and all sorts of concrete names for which we're not sure we have the exact translation. In any case, she is the lily of the valley. And he responds, as a lily among the brambles, so is my love among maidens. I'd like to just pause a moment to suggest here, and then we'll take a break, that at this point, we may get a reflection back on this girl. She's lovely for sure, but she's rustic and she has a sunburn, and any maiden from the court would surely keep herself unsunburned. And yet, if she's loved by her beloved, then she is the most beautiful of all. I've talked about this a little bit with my students in class, and I've asked them, at a wedding, who is the most beautiful girl in the wedding? Even if, maybe back home, the bride is rather homely and homespun and plain. And, you know, everyone hears out immediately, why, of course, the bride is the most beautiful. Why is she the most beautiful? Usually they answer, well, because she's wearing the wedding gown. That's where they flunk, right? She should be the most beautiful because why? Why is she radiant? She's loved. She knows she's loved. She has been chosen of all the rest. And so he says here, as a lily among the brambles. I think I hear tremendous mutuality in this poem, which we, I think, will delight in more and more as we go along. Okay, I want to pause here a second and see if any of you have some comments or questions. We've looked at the first two sections, kind of the introduction and the opening dialogue. And now we're going to go on to the real love lyrics, which finally lead up to the wedding. So any comments or questions or observations? Okay, I promise you that the poem gets much more passionate as we go along. And I do not understand all of the references. Sometimes they're very specific. And they may appear almost to be, some people have suggested, lewd, but they're anything but lewd and pornographic. Because always the love of the two is couched in language that's eloquent. As C.S. Lewis calls it, golden poetry. It's extravagant, it's ornate, it's picturesque. And when people say those kinds of things, they are looking not just at one another's physical self, but they're looking at each other as persons. Okay, as an apple tree among the trees, this is the bride speaking again, so is my beloved among young men. With great delight I sat in his shadow, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He brought me to his banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. A lot of you probably recognize that from a song that we love to sing. People who translate this very physically suggest that this may already be the ultimate embrace of the lover. So you can see that if you take the physical, the literal, and translate it into physical love, it may already indeed be very intimate. The subsequent words may suggest that too. Sustain me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I'm sick with love. She expresses her longing without reserve. Maybe it's a playful conversation back and forth. Oh, that his left hand were under my head and his right hand embraced me. And now an interesting word. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem. Still the bride speaking, or is it the groom? It's been suggested the groom. By the gazelles and the hinds or the deer or the field, that you stir not up nor awaken love until it flees. Some people read that moralistically, namely, don't stir up love in another person until you're ready to follow through responsibly. But probably this is much more intimate here, and it's saying do not disturb the lovers until they're ready to be disturbed. There have been other suggestions that one is sleeping and don't wake the other one up until it's the appropriate time to wake him up. So as you can see, there are a variety of ways of looking at that passage. Now we get one of the most enchanting poem here. This is the bride describing her beloved coming to her and then enticing her away with an enchanting song. The voice of my beloved. She hears his voice. She doesn't see him yet. Behold, he comes leaping upon the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle, a young stag. Behold, there he stands behind our wall, gazing in at the windows, looking through the lattice, peeking in to see. My beloved speaks and says to me, arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. For lo, winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers appear in the earth. The time of singing has come. The voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig puts forth its figs, and the vines are in blossom. They give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. Oh, my dove, in the cleft of the rock, in the covert of the cliff, let me see your face. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is comely. Perhaps the companions, the chorus sings here, catch us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil our vineyards that are in bloom. One suggestion here is that the implication of that is that anyone who would in any way frustrate the love of these two lovers should be captured and pulled away. You can hear a much more passionate desire, both on his part as well as on her part. And it's interesting that it's her lyric where she cites him singing to her. So there's that mutuality, which I've mentioned before. My beloved is mine and I am his. He pastures his flock among the lilies. Until the day breathes and the dead of fleas, turn, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag upon a mountain. That's the bride again. And many believe that here we have something like the consummation of their love with each other. Now we get a poem in this group here that suggests something else. People have thought it may be a dream poem. Upon my bed by night, I sought him whom my soul loved. Perhaps he really is gone, and now we're agonizing through the separation, the problem of separation between two who love each other. I sought him, found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. And then she rises and goes about the city. Is she really doing that, or is that happening in her dream? In the streets and the squares, I will seek him whom my soul loves. In any case, her desire is it is not to be stopped. She will search after him whom she loves. The watchmen found me, and as they went about the city, have you seen him whom my soul loves? She asked. Scarcely had I passed them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house, into the chamber of her that conceived me. And again that refrain, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem. To comment a moment about verse 4, it's interesting that the great joy of reunion is expressed there in just a few lines so intensely. And what is added to that is her intention now to bring him to her mother's room. That clearly, at least most commentators take that clearly to imply that she, though she has fallen in love with him in the most intimate secrecy of her heart, wants and is not going to be satisfied until it's marriage. Obviously, why do you take a man to your mother's room other than to say, Mother, this is the man I want to marry? So this is one of the clues that it's heading towards marriage, and that will be unfolded most dramatically now, beginning with verse 6. Here we get something like the wedding procession. What is that coming up from the wilderness? Like a column of smoke perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the fragrant powders of the merchant. Behold, it is the litter of Solomon. About it are 60 mighty men of the mighty men of Israel, all girt with swords and expert in war, each with his sword on his thigh against the alarms by night. Isn't it, as we're in the middle of this procession, having read everything else, very difficult to imagine how one could sustain an allegorical interpretation of this poem? That is to say, isn't it really impressively obvious that it has to do with physical love, and that we're straining to say, well, no, it's not really about that, it's about something else altogether? I mention that here because this is this famous litter of Solomon, which is the temple and all of the other things that I mentioned. King Solomon made himself a palanquin. That's one of those Eastern carriages where a man sits in a kind of a box with carried by several poles, and then he is lifted up in the air and brought along in that way. So I don't know if the Jewish people ever had that type of a carriage, but the word is used here, and something like it is implied in the Hebrew. Made from the woods of Lebanon, he made its posts with silver, gold, purple, lovingly wrought, perhaps with inlaid metals by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and behold King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart. So these lines suggest the wedding day with the very term wedding. We may have to skip some of the passages, but I would like to look at four because it's one of those typical, chapter 4, emblematic blazon poems. Here the beloved is compared to objects. And generally, the poet is not so much interested in evoking physical resemblances, like that's what her hair looks like, that's what her eyes look like, as some of our poets do. Her eyes were like the sparkling sun, or her hair was like the golden hay, and this type of visual comparison, but rather there's a transference of value. Okay, your eyes are dove. He starts out by saying she is beautiful, so he's going to enumerate her beauty and her worth and her value. With the second comparison, we'll have a little more trouble. Your hair is like a flock of goats moving down the slopes of Gilead. I don't know if you've ever seen a flock of goats in the mountains. If you have, actually, it's a really beautiful sight. If you're far away, they just move. And it is a beautiful sight. And I think it may, in a way, suggest the flowing and the movement in the hair. But still, you see a direction that's of the poem, and that we'll see more of it in the very next line. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one of them is bereaved. Now, what does that say? Can any of you guess? Yes. Not just lovely teeth, but she has all of them. They're all there. Remember, this was the age before dentistry. All of which bear twins. You know, there's a matching set of teeth. Your lips are like a scarlet thread. Your mouth is lovely. One translation has, your words are delightful. Your cheeks are like halves of pomegranate behind your veil. The pomegranate, I think, is a very reddish. So again, that might refer to her rustic, sunburnt color. But notice she still is behind her veil. So that sense of chasteness amidst all of the passion is so interesting. Your neck, this is the one I like, is like the Tower of David, built for an arsenal, whereon hang 1,000 bucklers, all of them shields of warriors. Obviously, there's a transfer of value here to something that is of ultimate worth in Israel's history, David's tower and its splendid defense. Your two breasts are like two fawns. Some of you have been seeing the fawns here, and I don't know if when you think, those of you who are married, of your wives, or wives think of themselves, or any of you, that you think of your breasts as fawns. But again, we're in a in an interesting world. Think Hebrew, right? We're in a pastoral world, using pastoral conventions, thinking of her as a country girl, and maybe in fact she is. Until the day breathes and the shadows flee, I will hie me to the mountains of myrrh and the hills of frankincense. Is this simply massive exaggeration, hyperbole, that Solomon coming from Jerusalem is, you know, going across the mountains to this girl who's living way in the north? Or are the mountains symbolisms of her in some way? Do you, the poem is strongly metaphoric, and we never know for sure. Depart from the peak of Amana, from the peak of Senir and Hermon, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards. Amana and Senir and Hermon, I think, are in the anti-Lebanon mountains. And that means that he is from the north, and he wants her to come down to him and be his bride. She is from the Lebanon area. Okay, you have ravished my heart. You have stolen my heart, he responds. How sweet is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better your love than wine. And he continues to extol her beauty and now speaks of her as the emotion gets more and more intense, as a garden locked, a fountain sealed. And then finally, perhaps she responds in verse 15. Some translations change this. I am a garden fountain, a well of living water, of flowing water, flowing streams. Awake, O north wind, come, O south wind. Blow upon my garden. That's probably she speaking. Let its fragrance be wafted abroad. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruit. The groom, I come to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gather my myrrh and my spice. I eat my honeycomb and my honey. I drink my wine with milk. And then with the companions responding, eat, O friends, and drink. Drink deeply, O lovers. We have the kind of conclusion of the section that leads up to something like consummation, probably, I think, implied marriage consummation. So that's a very intense part of the poem, and I think really beautifully put. So that the mutuality and the communion and the playfulness and the sensuousness are all marvelously fluid and interactive with a great sense of joy and mystery. A second dream. I slept, but my heart was awake. Hark, my beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is wet with dew. She hears his voice. My locks were the drops of the night. I had put off my garment. How could I put it off? How could I put it on again? This is incredibly candid in its implications. I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? My beloved put his hand to the latch. My heart was thrilled within me. I arose to open to my beloved. I opened to my beloved, but he had turned and gone. My soul failed when he spoke. Some people translate, when he spoke not. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. The watchman found me. So we know she's out looking for him again in the city. This time they catch her, beat me, wounded me, took away my mantle. They really abused her. And again, the refrain. Here there's a tremendous sense of pain, of separation. And now someone almost seems to challenge her in the voice of the companion. What is your beloved more than another beloved, O fairest among women? And so on. How does she respond? Now she praises him in the same way that he had once praised her. And I won't read through this enumeration of his beauties, but they are very similar in kind, an emblematic blazon where things are described that make him most worthy. But she finally does express her feelings that thus he is altogether desirable in her beloved. Once again, they challenge her, well, where has he gone? And then the bride responds in verse 2, well, he's gone to his garden, to the bed of spices. I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. He pastures his flock among the lilies. Somehow it sounds like reunion has happened. In any case, she knows he is coming to the garden again. There's another song here by the groom, very similar to one that we read before. So I will skip this, if you don't mind, and go on to the verse 13, where the companions say, return, return. And this is the first time that she's named, Shulamite. Perhaps because she comes from a little village called Shulem, or maybe because it's meant to echo Abishag, the Shunammite, who was a lovely young virgin who was given to King David in his old age. So commentators think it may meant to echo that whole story a bit. In any case, they say, return that we may look upon you. Perhaps she responds here and says, why should you look upon the Shulamite? And then they say, in return, for the dance, or perhaps the counter dance, maybe a dance between two lines of soldiers or army. In any case, now the groom describes her in a dance, and he describes her from not head to toe, but toe to head. And when he finally does come to the head, as you see, he speaks about the beauty of her thighs, her navel, her belly, her breasts, her neck, her eyes, her nose. Her nose is like a Tower of Lebanon, by the way, overlooking Damascus. But notice at the end he says, a king is held captive in the tresses. We're running short of time, and so I'm going to skip, if you don't mind, to near the end, where there seem to be a set of fragmentary poems that conclude, but that don't go to the end necessarily, but may even suggest a time long before the marriage, or publicly. She says, oh, that you were like a brother to me that nursed at my mother's breast. If I met you outside, I would kiss you. In other words, oh, that there were no barriers between me showing my love to you. Now if we take this as a story, something's completely out of whack. But if it's a collection of poems, then it's interesting that sort of modulates to the end of the cycle and perhaps suggests how it's a song that could go on and on. Many people have argued intensely about verses 6, 7, and 8, thinking some that that's the climax of the poem, because now something general is said about love. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. That's still the groom speaking. But now he makes a generalization, the only one in the entire poem. Love is as strong as death. In other words, love conquers all. Right? Only death conquers all. Love is as strong as death. And then the next line would be a parallel to it. Its flashes are flashes of fire, a most vehement flame. That's the one place where the name of God might be hidden. The word vehement flame might be translated flame of Yah. Not Yahweh, but just the first syllable of Yahweh. We'll wrap it up quickly, but I'd like to, if I may, come and bring to an end. In chapter 8, verse 8, we get to a time probably when she's a little girl. We have a little sister. She has no breath. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken? If she is a wall, we will build upon her a battlement of silver. That is to say, if she's kept herself closed off to men. If she is a door, we will board her up. I was a wall, she said, and my breasts were like towers, unassailable. And then finally at the end, there's a little dialogue, much puzzlement about who's speaking here, and a concluding invitation once more of mutual love, make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag upon the mountain of spices. One concluding word, if I may. I think the poem indeed celebrates the love of a man and a woman in marriage, in its mystery and joy. A very romantic, almost impossible picture, and beset with enormous temptations on every side. Perhaps the poem points to the New Testament in part, because we all know that we're far from that, even at our most perfect moments of love. And so though the poem may not be an allegory, yet it's interesting that God's relation to Israel is often compared, and Christ's relation to the church, compared to a husband-wife. Maybe in order to appreciate what God's relation to us can be, this poem gives us an interesting parallel. That type of love, that type of mutuality.